Welcome, long haulers, endurance riders, resolutionists, and dreamers to another episode of Right Minded. And I am accompanied today, as always, by my ever persistent co-host, Grant Faulkner. And Grant, I say that you're persistent because I think any writer who resolves to do this kind of work of committing to the process of writing, of revision, of shopping their work, of getting published, pretty much has to be persistent. And I guess I know a handful of writers who've had it relatively easy, who breezily wrote something and easily got it published, but it is definitely not the norm. The more common thing is the stereotype of the long-suffering writer who's a 30-year overnight success. And so I'm curious how you see yourself, you know, through the lens of the long-suffering writer, or are you just tenacious?
I think both and many other things. I love the stories of the 30-year overnight successes. And when I think back to my own life as a writer, especially because I, you know, really doggedly wanted to get published early on, that was my dream, my aspiration. But I had very minimal publishing success in the early years. And early years means like a couple decades, to the extent that, like, in retrospect, I kind of wonder why I was persisting, because no one was going out of their way to tell me I was a good writer or encourage me in any special way. And I didn't start getting published with any sort of regularity, at least with fiction, until the last decade or so. And I've known some writers who seemingly had it easy, like you mentioned, and it's easy to be envious of those who seem blessed in that way. But I find that most writers, once you uncover their story, they've worked much harder than you know for that success. And so it's a little bit different than it appears sometimes. And I have one friend who published her first novel when she was 30 and to decent acclaim, but then didn't publish another one for 15 years. And that 15-year gap was pretty hellish for her. She was very tortured by the fact that she couldn't get another novel published. So just because you've made it doesn't mean you've made it for good, I guess. I also think that writers need to question this word success, because the reason I persisted through all those years of not being published, the reason my tenacity was a joy and my long-suffering state wasn't all about suffering, was that I minimized the dream of making it. I think at some point, you have to write for a higher purpose than any breakthrough or commercial success, and define success by the way you write with truth and integrity, by the way creating and writing makes you a better person and makes life a richer experience.
Yeah, I so agree with that. And I've honestly felt grateful over the years that I am not a career novelist or writer or someone who's known that that's what I wanted to do from a really young age, because I think it is a tough road. I mean, in fact, it's beyond tough to have those kind of aspirations. And then you look out at all of these heroes who've arrived where you want to be. And of course, that can happen in any industry, but it's extra grueling in the arts. I think it sets up a situation where it's easy to feel envy, or where you're apt to look at someone else and see what they have and then wonder whether it's ever going to be possible that you'll get there yourself. And when we interviewed Meg Wolitzer recently, she talked about the schlep. And I think that it's a great description for people who put in the work, because it is a schlep. It's kind of a perfect way to describe it. Writing a book requires so much, and then you have no idea when you're a new writer to the whole endeavor, whether it will even sell in the first place or whether it will have a readership. It may or may not do well. And then you're back at it, writing the next one and going through the whole process again. And I remember when I had the great honor of interviewing Mary Carr on stage a few years ago, I asked her about whether she encouraged people to write memoir. And her typical wry Mary Carr response was, "Well, you know, if you don't have to do this, if you can live a happy life, ... You know, she was essentially saying, like, don't do it. And I laughed because she's hilarious, but she actually has a test in the art of memoir where she encourages people to see if they're psychologically ready, as she puts it, to climb into their own skull and see what's up there. And that's for memoirists, of course, but I think she'd give the same advice to novelists or any kind of writer, which would be, look, you'll likely have it easier if you don't have this drive or if you don't have this compulsion to put your words on the page. But as evidenced by the ever-increasing number of books published every year, so many people do want to write and self-express. And I think we're seeing that, in fact, a lot of people are not going to be living happier lives unless they're writing. And so I'm imagining you might relate to that, Grant. Do you think that you'd be able to live a happy life if you didn't write?
Good question. Really good questions, and questions I definitely delve into with a degree of regularity. In fact, I think I could write a book about that one, because every writer I know has second-guessed the decision to become a writer. And I think that's because the low moments of being a writer and sort of the daily struggle that's embedded into writing anything, it can just be lower than what some other professions hold. You don't get necessarily a lot of approbation for being a writer, and you don't get a lot of money for it. So it's easy to question the happiness that it gives. I'm thinking about this through the lens. I just wrote an essay on the dancer and choreographer Martha Graham's notion that to be a creator is to live in a state of divine dissatisfaction, as she puts it. And she means that you live in a state of never quite being satisfied. You're always in pursuit, always trying to make your work better. And what I like about this notion is that she actually found her truest satisfaction in the assiduousness of her practice, which was for her was akin to a religious observance. And practice for her, she defined it as that it meant to perform over and over again in the face of all obstacles, some act of vision, of faith, of desire, in an effort to overcome the primary sin that she knew was mediocrity. And so I think, you know, this type of practice doesn't serve to shape your work into a form that necessarily pleases others so that it will get published. But this practice serves as a higher calling, one that has no concerns with whether a work finds acceptance or not, because it speaks to a more elevated and even sacred truth. And I think that this type of satisfaction in the end is what, you know, provides peace and happiness. You know, it's a strange sort of happiness, but it's also a higher form of happiness. So that's how I'd answer your question.
Yeah, and I like that a lot. It is a strange form of happiness, but it stems from something so much deeper. And I think it connects to values and what we care about and meaning and purpose. And today we're talking about persistence, and it takes persistence to get to that place. And I think it also, you're required to engage in that persistence to tap into that thing that drives you in that way. And it's a big part of what creates successful writers. And a couple of weeks back, in the takeaway, I shared an exercise that I'd done at a workshop with Liz Gilbert, which was to write yourself a letter from your persistence. And I've done this exercise with my memoir students, and it's profoundly encouraging, because what we do is we ask the students to write a letter from their persistence and then another one from their inspiration. And then they share one of the letters out loud. And usually about 90% of the students share the letter from their persistence. And the reason for this, I've come to believe, is because people are proud of their persistence. Like, inspiration is cool and it can be motivating, but it's definitely less satisfying in some ways, which is kind of what you were speaking to with Martha Graham, because you're inspired usually by something outside of yourself. That is, unless you're a total narcissist, right? But persistence, on the other hand, is innate, and persistence comes from within. So I really believe that a lot of authors who touch into their persistence are just moved by what they discover there. And so if you're on this journey, I encourage you to encourage yourself around your persistence and acknowledge the role that it's played.
That's so interesting, Brooke. You know, I've been known to say that to be rejected is to be an author, but also to be persistent is to be an author. And I love that definition that you give it, that there's something about persistence that people are proud of it when they show it. And it is amazing to me how much persistence just goes into writing the first draft of a novel. I'm impressed by everybody who writes 10,000 words of a novel in November. I find that so impressive. That's a lot of words. And then, you know, once you've written a rough draft, multiply that. It takes 10 times as much persistence to finish it. And that's before you do the whole publishing journey. And the persistence, it's fueled, you know, in the end, I think, by a belief in yourself and your project, and a belief in the whole crazy endeavor of writing, that what you write is necessary and urgent, that you're not wasting your time, even if your work isn't published. I think that's really key, is not to question the end product so much, but just to focus, like Martha Graham, on the practice, on honing your skills through persistence.
Right. And the reason we're even talking about persistence today, in part, is because of our guest, Nancy Davis Coe, who for sure, in my opinion, wins a persistence award. Nancy is local and a friend of mine, and we've worked together at various points over the years. And we first met when she was working on her memoir. And Nancy is definitely a go-getter type, and she's been widely published in different venues because she's a journalist and a freelance writer. But her memoir didn't sell. And when it didn't, she started churning around other ideas for books. And I'd see her every so often, and she'd have a different book idea. And then she started a podcast. And it was always I thought anyway, with the eye on getting traditionally published. And so she was doing all these things, building a platform with a degree of intentionality that was pretty unparalleled. And so I wasn't at all surprised, though very, very happy for her, when she let me know that she sold her proposal to Running Press, and then her book, The Thank You Project, just came out at the end of last year. And so it is a story of persistence across a lot of fronts. And there was the not selling the first book, there was the coming up with ideas for other books while trying to land on the right thing, and then the thing of building an author platform and really getting everything aligned for success. And so I'm also inspired by people like Nancy, because I see that they have a goal, but there's some dancing with that goal that has to happen, right? It's like seeing it through, but it's not going to always be particularly linear. And so it'll be fun to hear Nancy's story about this journey. And I also think it gives writers a lot of hope for what's possible when you have the stamina and when you're willing to do the dance.
Yeah, I was going to say, beyond belief, the fuel of persistence, it is stories of other people's persistence. And I just want to share one really quickly, because it's one of my favorites. And I know I've mentioned this before on the podcast. In fact, we've had him on as a guest, Kwame Alexander. And what I'm so impressed by, well, he calls himself a 26-year overnight success story, which really is the best way to sum it up, because for 26 years, he was working very hard to be an author, and he hadn't had any breakthroughs. In fact, he was self-publishing his work and selling it at farmers markets. And his novel, I think it's a YA or middle grade novel for kids, The Crossover, you're written in verse and written mainly for boys, you know, it just didn't find a receptive market from editors or agents. And so he was resigned to that he was going to self-publish that. And in fact, he was asking his father for a loan so that he could self-publish it and sell it at his stand at the farmer's market. And after, I think it was 25 or 26 rejections, one last publisher said that they would publish it. And it became this amazing, you know, bestseller. And he's since gone on to, you know, write numerous bestsellers and just, you know, be a wonderful author in many regards. So, you know, I take a lot of hope and inspiration from stories like that, from Kwame's and Nancy's.
Yeah, me too. And thanks for sharing that one again, Grant. It is good to remember. And it's good to call back from previous episodes, because a lot of you are new listeners and we've had some pretty amazing guests, Kwame included. But for now, let's ask our listeners to exercise a little endurance with us, and we'll be right back after a super short break.
So, Brooke, they say that knowledge is power, and thanks to the Great Courses Plus, we get to tap into this power with just one click.
Right, and we've been sharing with listeners this amazing streaming service. Yes, because they're sponsoring our show, but also because in actual fact, you can unlock unlimited access to objective, reliable, fascinating information on virtually any subject.
And don't forget that you also learn from the brightest minds around the world, benefiting from their years of experience and unique insight to help formulate our own knowledge and perspectives.
Right. So we can transform our listeners from students into masters and take over the world.
Woohoo. That's quite an ambition. What's one course you've watched lately, Brooke?
Well, funny enough, for as many great writing classes as there are, there's also so much other fantastic stuff. And since I want James to watch educational content, I sometimes let him choose. And recently he chose zoology, largely, I think, because we recently saw Jumanji 2. And so if you've seen the movie, then you get it. I think my point is, parents, grandparents, this is a really great way to get easy educational content for your kids, too. So how about you, Grant?
Yeah, like you, I like the way they're hitting up the parents and the grandparents. I'm going to add aunts and uncles too. Yeah, since I've been toying around with writing a memoir and or some personal essays, I was happy to discover a course on writing creative nonfiction. And speaking of kids, though, I mentioned to my daughter, Simone, who is 14, how I'd read that the number one thing that kids need help on as college freshmen is writing skills. So she's actually taking a course called High School Language Arts.
The point here is that this power of knowledge can be yours too when you sign up for the Great Courses Plus.
And they're offering our listeners their best deal ever, a free trial plus, ready for this, Brooke, half off their 3-month plan. And my trusty calculator tells me that that's just $10 a month for unlimited knowledge. But to take advantage of this incredible offer, you must sign up today using our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. Right-minded's all one word. One more time, thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. We're here with Nancy Davis Coe today, and Nancy is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in The Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, Us Magazine, The Rumpus, and The Toast. She's been recognized as a voice of the year in the humor category by Blogger and was the inaugural champion of Oakland's Literary Death Match. She covers the years between being hip and breaking one at midlifemixtape.com and on her podcast, Midlife Mixtape Podcast. And Nancy's recent book, The Thank You Project, Cultivating Happiness, One Letter of Gratitude at a Time, was published in December of last year by Running Press. And you can find out more about Nancy on her site, davisco.com. And hey, Nancy, I am over the moon to have you on the show. Thanks for being here.
I am so gratified to be here. It's great to be with you and Grant. So thank you so much.
So I want to start by having you share your journey to publication. And I guess I mean the short version, because I know there were some twists and turns, including a book that didn't sell and more than a few ideas and an author platform that you built with the power of your will. So can you tell us the most grueling and the best parts of that story?
I just feel like I should be standing with my fist clenched to the air. The power of my will. I built my platform. I will give you the very Reader's Digest version. About 13 years ago, after having a very happy career doing international business, I decided, no, I'm a writer. That's what I am. So I had to pretty much start from scratch and started taking classes and workshops and went to conferences. And so I wrote a book. It took me 6 years to write that one. It lives in my office. If anyone wants to come check it out, there's the single copy. Then I started a completely different kind of book, and that one was a lot more humor oriented. It felt a lot more familiar and comfortable with the kind of writing that I had been doing more and more of. I started my blog in 2011, Midlife Mixtape, and that was sort of the place where I burned enough words to find the ones that felt comfortable to me to write, which is usually a combination of funny and a little bit poignant, hopefully, and entertaining. Obviously, I love music, so there's sometimes a music angle to what I write. You can't have a blog and a podcast with mixtape in the title without outing yourself as a music fan. So it was that second book, the what I used to call the midlife music crisis memoir, where I actually got in touch with Brooke, because I felt like one of the ways that I was going to improve as a writer is working one-on-one with a book coach. And so that's how you came into my orbit. And it was a really excellent experience in terms of, there were so many times where I would say to Brooke, I'm not going to work on this anymore. And Brooke would say, no, you are going to write chapter 9 and bring it back to me in 2 weeks. And that was how that book got finished. So there was no ifs, ands, and buts about it. But at the end of the day, and this was, I think, 2015, that book didn't find, so I had an agent, but I didn't find a publisher for it. And I was sort of licking my wounds over that and trying to figure out what I was going to do next. And I decided what I would do is start a podcast. And so the show was all meant to be sort of the flip side of midlife as a crisis. And as I was doing that, just to bring it all back to the book, I was feeling like I was about to turn 50 in 2016 was going to be my big birthday year. And I decided that, you know, I really needed to acknowledge that I had come through some hard times and I'd had help all along the way to do that. So I was going to write one thank you letter every week of my 50th year to someone who had helped or shaped or inspired me. And that's all I was doing. I was going to write 50 thank you letters and that was going to be it. And it turned out 2016, you know, besides being a presidential election year, which was filled with a little bit of rancor, it was a year I lost my dad suddenly. My oldest daughter left for college across country, which certainly wasn't a sad thing, but it was a big adjustment. And I kept finding that sitting down to write the letters was something that made me feel physically and mentally better every single week. And so it became the way that I got through a rather difficult year. And about 18 months later, I kept having people who had heard about what I started calling it the Thank You Project. People were saying to me, how did you do it? Who'd you decide to write to? What did you put in the letters? And it wasn't until that point where I thought, oh, maybe people would want a book that tells them how to do this. So that is where this book came from. I just last spring of 2018 is when I put a proposal together. And what was really important to me that that was different from the letter writing practice itself is I wanted the book to go into the science of why this worked, because I was just curious about it. I knew I felt better writing thank you letters, but I had no idea why. So the book that came out in the beginning of December is kind of a how-to, kind of a memoir, includes a lot of science, this emerging science of positive psychology about why gratitude and happiness are so tightly coupled. And so my hope for the book is that people who read it will, even if they never write a letter, as they go through the book and read about all the different categories of people I suggest that you write to, that they'll think about who those people are in their own lives. And the science says that even just thinking about those people will put you in a better frame of mind.
I'm in a better frame of mind right now.
Good. See?
As you were talking, magic. I was thinking about doing this very project myself because it sounds so interesting. And it's rare that we actually thank people in our lives in this way, and especially go searching them out through letter writing. And letter writing is one thing I'm very interested in with this. Your book stems from a letter you wrote to your father in 2016, and you share that letter in the introduction to your book. And it's a beautiful, touching letter. And your dad loved it so much that he had it framed. And then that letter led to the letter writing project and ultimately the thank you project, as you said. Well, what about the concept of this book, though, do you think made your agent and publishers say to themselves, yeah, this is the one, we want to publish this?
I think the feeling in the world is we have to find ways to keep ourselves sane and connected during a time when so much of the news is negative. I do think that resonated for people who saw the proposal, this idea that there is this pretty simple, straightforward, again, I tried to write it with humor, you know, that there's kind of this fun book to read that will also make you feel better, that will also act to counterbalance some of what's in the news. But I want to mention one other thing that I think had appeal, and it goes back to those two books that didn't get published. I had 13 years to build a writing platform. There were 13 years before my first book got published. And what I did during that time was get to know other writers, promote their work, watch how they were marketing things, get really skilled with social media placements and Twitter. And, you know, I used that time. In some ways I could look back and say, oh, you know, I failed on two books, but I never think about it that way. Cause what I think is I spent 13 years building a writing platform that made two publishers sit up and take notice. And I've just leveraged it. I mean, I really, and I don't mean this to sound transactional. It's not like I was doing it in order for one day, you know, when I wrote a book, I was going to come back and call in all my chips, but I really genuinely was happy to share what my friends were doing. I have gotten to know so many people who are beautiful writers doing important work. And it's a joy and a privilege to share that stuff out. And then for me now to see the seeds of that harvest where my friends are saying to me, hey, I'm going to do a giveaway for you, or I'm going to, you know, put this on. I've been on a ton of podcasts from different friends who've had, you know, who have shows. And that's the sort of thing that if I had gotten published with my first book, none of that would have been in place. And I'm sure that book wouldn't have gone very far. So anybody who's feeling frustrated, that's just been my message when I talk to people who are writers, is just stick with it. Keep doing good work on behalf of other people too. And it'll come back. It'll be worth it in the end.
I love that message. And I'm totally tracking you there. And when you were working on your memoir, we would talk from time to time about the uphill battle that memoirists face when they don't have a platform. And your book is not exactly a memoir, but it certainly has memoir aspects to it. And you did start blogging regularly and you started your podcast. So I'm wondering if you could tell listeners, what were other key components to building a platform? And how much do you think that platform figured into the selling of this book?
I think both the blog and the podcast were important because I could point to audiences who were familiar with my voice and are likely to want to buy the book. And in neither case is, you know, I'm not a number one Apple podcast or anything like that. But the people who listen to my show listen again and again. They're subscribers. And the people who read the blog, again, you know, are loyal. And so I've been, you know, I think those two pieces of it were huge. I'm not saying everybody needs to have a blog and a podcast, but whatever it is, your Instagram feed or your Pinterest page or whatever you do, that gives people a consistent sense of who you are and what you're about. And if you can then tie that into whatever it is, whatever creative work you're bringing out into the world, I think people really are cheering you on. I mean, that's what's been touching to me, is to hear from readers and listeners who I've never met who say, Nancy, I pre-ordered, you know, for my book club and I told my library to stock it. They don't know me. They don't owe me anything like that, but they know my voice and they have a reasonable expectation that they're going to like the book that I wrote. And just being able to draw on that, I think, has been really valuable, both from my point of view and from the publisher's point of view.
Well, today's show is about persistence, and I'm curious to know whether you think about your own persistence much. Are you particularly known for your persistence, and what has kept you driving through this? You're laughing already.
I'm laughing because I'm looking at the sign in my office that said, she believed she could, so she did.
Oh, wow. There we go. In the question.
Given to me by my 21-year-old daughter.
Yeah. But did she give you that to spur on your persistence, or to honor the persistence that was already there?
I don't think I'm particularly known for persistence. No, I think I struggle with it as much as anybody does. And there were so many points along the way where I just thought, I'm not good enough to have a book published. I actually think when I started the podcast, I think a little bit I was throwing up my hands and saying, maybe I'm not a writer. I'm just going to do this podcasting thing. Maybe that will be the creative outlet. And it turned out I missed writing so much that I just kept writing. So podcasting was a way to augment my creativity and nothing else. But I think what has helped a lot with persistence is that I'm in a writing group. And I can't imagine telling any of the people in my writing group that I was giving up, because I think they would get on a plane and come beat me up. We all we meet virtually via cell phone all day, every day. We have a text thread that's been going for 4 years. And these are all humor writers who I met, believe it or not, at the Irma Bombach Humor Writing Conference, probably 7 years ago now. And I think it's so important to have those people in your lives when you're a writer. It's a solitary thing. It's rife with rejection. If you're doing it right, you're probably getting rejections. And it's so tempting to walk away from it. And you need other people to tell you that's not an option for you. And then you need to be that person for other people too. And I think that has been critically important. And it was, throughout my creative career, since I hooked up with this group of writers, there's always questions in this text group. Who are you submitting that essay to? How's your book going? What's going on with this, with this speech that you're writing, or whatever the creative output is? And I think the accountability that can come through a writing group is critical. I don't think any of us would be where we are. These are all people who are doing different things creatively, and none of us would be where we are if it weren't for the group. So I'm a big fan of a writing group. And you don't have to be in the same place with them.
Yay for accountability structures. We talk about it a lot on the show, so it's awesome to hear how tight-knit that group is. So back to your book, what was the most touching experience you've had during the entirety of the Thank You Project, whether that was the letter writing part or the writing of the book and publishing part or since publication?
Wow. I think I opened with what was probably the most touching thing, and that was that I had written this letter to my dad, and 6 months later he was gone. And I never, my father was a very robust 81-year-old guy. I never expected that we would lose him that year. So it meant everything to me to know that he had read how I felt about him. And as Grant pointed out, he did frame it, because that's totally on brand with Larry Davis. I was really, really glad that I'd taken the time to do that. And I think that's part of the reason I felt so much that I wanted to get this book out into the world, is I don't want other people to miss that opportunity. You know, that meant so much to me. And I think it's so easy. It doesn't take that long to write a letter like this and to make that difference for the person reading it and for themselves. So I think that was probably, if I had to pick one thing, that was probably it. But there have been a lot of, I'm just happy the book's been out for a little bit now, and I'm starting to hear from people who say, gave the book along with a thank you letter I wrote to that person, you know, as a holiday gift, or I've just written to somebody I hadn't talked to in a long time. And my vision for 2020 is just, let's have thank you letters going in every direction so that all of us having a bad day will have a letter we can open and read to remind us that somebody else values us. So that's what I would like to see. I'm saving the U.S. Postal Service one letter at a time.
Well, Nancy, congratulations on your success, and thanks again for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Nancy.
Thank you both so much for having me on the show.
We will be right back with this week's takeaway.
Today's takeaway asks you to write your own thank you letter. Before you even do this, I recommend reading Nancy's book, The Thank You Project. It's the kind of book that you can dip into almost anywhere, and she has examples of her own letters, things to think about before you set out to write a letter, and examples of the kinds of people in your life you might write letters to, all of which is very helpful. And the whole thing is very moving. And doing this exercise does something else, which is that it helps remind us all of what we're grateful for and why. And it cultivates general gratitude, which is amazing and good for the soul and good for the heart and the body and the brain too. The letter doesn't have to be long, but for the purposes of what we're doing on Right Minded, maybe consider narrowing down the parameters to write to someone who's supported you on your writing journey, or even consider writing a thank you letter to your own book. These exercises are actually incredible for what they reveal, things that you know but maybe haven't spoken aloud. And doing this kind of writing also locks in meaning. And meaning drives purpose, and purpose drives productivity. So do yourself this small favor and brighten someone else's life too. It's a double whammy of goodness.
And we have a triple whammy of goodness for you here to close things out. I'm going to read one of the fantastic reviews that one of our listeners has posted on iTunes. And we encourage you to leave reviews, or just a starred rating would be wonderful. So Karmapug writes, "Great, interesting educational podcast. So fun, you barely know you are learning so much. For men and women seeking encouragement and information on writing, editing, publishing, and so much more. Two congenial, knowledgeable, and experienced hosts. Thank you very much, Karmapug. And they get the greatest guests who know what they are talking about and are cutting edge current. Keep that November NaNoWriMo inspiration and that She Writes Press energy going all year long with tasty doses of this podcast right on." So here's to tasty doses of our weekly Right Minded podcast. Please download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And yeah, once again, if you can give us a little review, that'd be tremendous. We'll see you next week.